Thank you, Jennifer. That was really good. I appreciate the prayers. Can everybody hear me okay? It'll get louder as I lean down like that, so we didn't want to get it too loud. I wanted to thank Amy for, where is Amy, for organizing it. She's done this for several years. I know I'm part of the church here at Jordan Park, but I really appreciate them giving this opportunity every year. Most of the time I've been a student, so I've benefited from that. And thank Becky for all her efforts in helping us. Several people helped me out. You know who you are. Special thank you to Harriet. Where's she? She is a very good teacher in herself. I know a lot of you have taken her classes, but she was good to help me look up through pictures and some material. Over here to the side are books that some of you have lent to me and let me borrow. If you're interested in future resources about how to look up some of these things, those are the kinds of things you could look for. But if you also, if you gave me a book, you can pick that up over there, and I really do appreciate it. Why are we studying these women? Because we all feel the need to identify with a real example. You can just look at that and realize that when you think about a recipe card versus the food network. I can tell you there are lots of things that I have tried and cooked and been successful at because I was able to look at that and watch it. And so it makes a difference to have a real example. It makes a difference to have an emotional connection. If you think about a faceless charity calling you on the phone and wanting some money, you're not as likely to give to them as you are to the cause of leukemia when, say, your young cousin is suffering with leukemia. It makes a difference to have that emotional connection. Real examples give you a pattern to follow, inspiration to try it for yourself, and also confidence that it can be done because you're seeing them do it. Companies selling products know they have you and that you'll buy whatever they're selling if they can make that emotional connection. But you know what? God knew this first about us. Proverbs 4:23 says, "Above all else, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from it." Today I want to introduce you to two women of Acts, and I made a point when I was choosing my women to pick one who was considered a single, a woman alone, and one who was married. They're both living back in the first century while the church was being established. That was an exciting but also a very dangerous time, and honestly, I don't think I really appreciated that until I studied these two women more closely. This is at a time where women led much different everyday lives than we do, but in many ways they were still the same, and we can identify with them. Let's meet Lydia. This is your sheet, the paper that you have, Acts 16:11-15. So putting out to sea from Troas, we ran a straight course to Samothrace and on the day following to Neapolis, and from there to Philippi, which is a leading city of the district of Macedonia, a Roman colony. And we were staying in this city for some days, and on the Sabbath day we went outside the gate to a riverside where we were supposing that there would be a place of prayer. And we sat down and began speaking to the women who had assembled there. A woman named Lydia, from the city of Thyatira, a seller of purple fabrics, a worshiper of God, was listening, and the Lord opened her heart to respond to the things spoken by Paul. And when she and her household had been baptized, she urged us, saying, "If you have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come into my house and stay." And she prevailed upon us. I hope you'll look at these verses in a new light after today. While we're going to work through these few verses, you're also going to get some insight into a book that Liz recommended to all of us last year, The Joy of Discovery in Bible Study. Some of us studied through that this last year, and we can tell you that's really true. There really, really is joy discovering things on your own out of the Bible. So besides appreciating Lydia, I'd really like for everybody to get excited about digging into the Bible on their own. You're going to notice some of the techniques as we go through that today. And actually, we're hoping to offer a new and improved version of this class this fall, starting in October, and probably repeat it again in January. So yeah, that was just a shameless promotion for that class. This is where your pen and paper is going to come in handy. Please get out the verse drawn out here. I've left some space for you to kind of mark up that paper. We're going to read through that, and as we do, I want you to just mark up anything you notice about that. Keywords, something you'd like to know more about. I don't care if you underline it, circle it, mark it up. Whatever you do, just anything that catches your attention, and there's no right or wrong. What's noteworthy to me may not be to you. Okay, so putting out to sea from Troas, we ran a straight course to Samothrace, and on the day following to Neapolis, and from there to Philippi, which is a leading city of the district of Macedonia, a Roman colony. And we were staying in this city for some days. And on the Sabbath day, we went outside the gate to a riverside, where we were supposing that there would be a place of prayer. And we sat down and began speaking to the women who had assembled there. A woman named Lydia, from the city of Thyatira, a seller of purple fabrics, a worshiper of God, was listening, and the Lord opened her heart to respond to the things spoken by Paul. And when she and her household had been baptized, she urged us, saying, "If you have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come into my house and stay." And she prevailed upon us. Sure does encourage me to see these young girls up here marking away. I hope you marked a lot. Now, let me say a bit about treasure trails. You know, that little purple paper you had, and of course it has to be purple for Lydia. Once you start really looking into these things you've just marked and underlined, that's going to lead to some other things and some other things. I call those treasure trails, and they can be never-ending. Today, we're going to move pretty fast, but I wanted you to have a way to be able to note down things you want to follow up later. That's what the purple sheet's for. We're only going to cover half of what made my list. And we're going to need to stay focused on kind of where I'm going, so that way you can note it down. And now I'll show you what some of the things that I underlined. I was interested in who the we meant. Anytime something's given a name, that gives you a little more concrete to hold on to. You can look it up if it appears somewhere else. I was interested in Philippi, that it was a Roman colony, that on the Sabbath day I noted there was no synagogue, which a lot of times there usually is. It was a group of women out there praying. You have a woman named, another city named, a seller of purple fabrics. As you heard from Amy, that would have gotten my attention. A worshiper of God. Her heart responded. She had a household. She was baptized. She was intense. She urged and she prevailed upon us. She was even asking to be judged. So those are some of the things that came to my mind. Now, another technique, you take those things and you kind of put them in an organized form. This you might really not know where to get started with. So it just so happens mine kind of broke out into four easy groups. The we was the travelers, the cities, a few things that we knew about it, the Sabbath day and all the questions I might have come up with of a spiritual nature, and then several things to be noted about Lydia. The reason this is helpful is because now I can tackle these one at a time, and the puzzle will come together as I do, and it's not so overwhelming all at once. Now, your words and your groupings may turn out to be something totally different, and that's just fine. Today, we're going with mine. Okay, first, the we. The travelers who came to Lydia and turned things upside down in her life. Turn to Acts 15. Verse 36, please. After some days, Paul said to Barnabas, "Let us return and visit the brethren in every city in which we proclaimed the word of the Lord and see how they are." Okay, that's the first treasure trail right there. These men that are coming in to see Lydia have already been on another trip. That would be a whole interesting thing to check out, and it'll give you a lot of background information. Verse 39. There occurred a sharp disagreement that they separated from each other. That would be Paul and Barnabas. And Barnabas took Mark with him and sailed away to Cyprus. But Paul chose Silas and left. I'll tell you, that's another treasure trail to go down. That whole interaction of why they disagreed comes from an earlier time. There's lots of very interesting things that you're going to discover about Mark and lots of very interesting things you're going to discover about Barnabas. In fact, Barnabas could be a character study in himself. Okay, so let's look at the map. Paul and Barnabas started, I guess I could use this laser thing. They started here at Antioch, and they come up through here, and right here is where we're going to stop with them. They're in Lystra. Now, verse 41 says, Paul and Silas were going about strengthening the churches. So you see from that, so far they're carrying through with their mission, just like they intended. Chapter 16, verse 1, they come across another disciple, a young man well spoken of by the brethren, named Timothy. This young man is half Jew, half Greek, and because Paul wants him to come along, Paul circumcises him, and now you have three on the trip. Now, I'll just say there's a whole treasure trail about Paul feeling the need for Timothy to be circumcised. Back before this trip ever started, there was a big powwow to do with the Jew and Gentile issue, very interesting to study into. It had direct bearing on why he felt like he needed to be circumcised, but that would be for another day. We're going to stick with what's pertinent to Lydia. However, it is pertinent that this young man, Timothy, was circumcised before they headed on this trip. Now, from a kind of medical background, I can tell you that wouldn't have been an easy thing. An adult male circumcision would have taken 6 to 8 weeks to recover from in our modern time. He didn't get probably modern treatment. In fact, a lot of the things I read said they used sharpened stone. I can only hope there was something a little more sophisticated at that time. But I had never picked up before when you start and think about these little things about these travelers, how it would have made a difference. Also, several treasure trails right here. Timothy is half Jew, half Greek. That means he is a product from two parents who have religious differences. You can see his mother's a Jew, but he has come to this age and he's still not been circumcised. Was that a point of disagreement between his parents? He gets one now. Is his father still living, and is that an issue? What I think you can take away from this is, obviously, he had a family, two parents with religious differences, but yet where do you find him today? We find a spiritually mature young man ready to really sacrifice for the Lord. So it can be done. If any of you women are in that circumstance, it can be done. He is especially noteworthy as a Christian young man because he is also relatively new to the faith. If you would go back and look at one of those treasure trails about the first trip, Paul has come through his city possibly about 5 years earlier. That may be when his family learned about Christ. And I can't tell you when he became a Christian in there. He's just at that point now. So it's less than 5 years, and he's considered spiritually mature enough to be brought along on this trip with Paul. And I've just got to say, girls, right here, Timothy would be an awesome treasure trail for y'all to check into, digging up stuff on him. He had some adventures that would put Hollywood to shame. And we want you guys to be seekers. We all need to be excited about studying God's Word. And when you pick out people like that for children and you help them start digging out these treasures, and they can maybe on a wall create their own timeline, and as they discover things, they go post it up there. It makes them really connect with the story. Okay, so let's summarize what we've got so far. We haven't covered this today, but kind of all of us have some of this knowledge already. Three travelers, Paul, a known Jewish scholar and activist, now Christian convert and chosen apostle, able to do miracles and pass on spiritual gifts to others, very experienced in teaching to Jews and Gentiles. We have Silas, a much respected Christian leader from a very large congregation in Jerusalem with the spiritual gift of prophecy. And now we have Timothy, a young man of mixed heritage and culture, half Jew, half Greek, who was a fairly recent disciple, yet mature enough for Paul to want him to go and dedicated enough to undergo an adult circumcision and still travel. So do you feel like you've already added to your knowledge of the scriptures about Lydia that you might not have noticed before? We've got a whole lot more. All right. Another side note about these travelers, because we're fixing to move in Philippi, into Philippi. Philippi wasn't where they wanted to go at all. We're going to look at Acts 16:6. And as we, besides looking at why they didn't go where they wanted to go, there's another big issue there. You'll get bonus points if you pick it out. Okay, they passed through the Phrygian. I'm going to go back up here and show you this on the map as we talk about it. They passed through the Phrygian and Galatian region. Okay, so they've been in Lystra. Okay, so here they go up this way. Here's Phrygia. Here's Galatia. So they're passing through this region, having been forbidden by the Holy Spirit to speak the word in Asia. Okay, see right here's Asia. All this map helps because it's in colors. All this is yellow. They wanted to go over this way. Well, the Holy Spirit forbid them to do that. So they continue on. And after they came to Mysia, they were trying to go into Bithynia. Okay, up here. Here's Mysia. They got up into this area. They wanted to go this way. The Spirit of Jesus did not permit them. And so, passing by Mysia, they came down to Troas. This is key to our story, that first they wanted to go this way, and we're told no. Then they wanted to go this way, and we're told no. So pretty much, that's the way that's left to them. Something that's also very interested, following this path, all this area they were forbidden to go into, just go right over into here, and what do you see right there? Thyatira. This is Lydia's hometown. This was the area that Paul was forbidden to go into. When you go into some of the treasure trails, I'll recommend later about his other journeys, he is going to get to go into that area. In fact, he's going to go into that area this afternoon when we talk about Priscilla. Did anybody else see the bonus point thing? This was a huge thing for me that I just was blown away by. Oops, wrong way. Here we go. They passed through the region. They came. They were trying. They. But at the bottom, immediately, we saw it. God had called us. What just happened there? Third person plural to first person plural. I'll tell you what happened there that's a shocker to me. The person who was writing this story and saying they did this, now he's we, us, he's just stepped in to the story. What's significant about that, if you know Acts, that would be Luke. I've researched and researched. Luke wrote the Gospel of Luke and Acts. Luke was not present with Jesus during what he wrote about the Gospel of Luke, as best I can tell. Luke also was not present for any other part of Acts leading up to this very moment. So this is the first time the author of our whole story we're reading becomes a first-person participant in what he's going to write down later. So Luke was very careful, but so do you think he had a little bit more insight into what's going on and in recording it? Because this is the first time he's actually there. You know what else is significant about that? Luke, as a writer of some of the books of the New Testament, he was the only Gentile. That would have been big. All the rest of these were Jewish men. As a Gentile on this trip, do you think he bonded with Timothy some? As a physician, do you think he bonded with Timothy under having just undergone the circumcision? Having written Luke and Acts, you might not realize this, that constitutes the largest portion of the New Testament because of the amount covered in Luke and the amount covered in Acts. So what I just discovered, maybe you all already knew this, that the person who just stepped into this story wrote the largest portion of the New Testament. I'm really impressed with Luke. We get a little bit of insight into his mindset. In the very first opening of his first book, he explains how he comes to be writing this. Many have tried to report on the things that happened among us. They have written the same things that we learned from others, the people who saw those things from the beginning and served God by telling people his message. Since I myself have studied everything very carefully from the beginning, most excellent Theophilus, it seemed good for me to write it out for you. I arranged it in order to help you know that what you have been taught is true. It kind of gives me goosebumps to think about a man like this being so very careful in writing down the story and him actually being present in it. Did anybody else know that? That's what I'm telling you. When you get into these things and you dig and you discover, it will always mean a lot to me just because of that. Okay, now, we're done with we. You know that whole column of travelers? Now we're ready to move into Philippi and some of the cities. Okay, so we left our brothers in Troas, and it turned into we, and they are going to sail across the sea over here right into Philippi. Now, Philippi was a highly favored Roman colony. That was probably because many famous battles had been fought in that area, and maybe more probably because there was rich gold mines in the area. But it was key that they were a colony. That afforded them some privileges. They were free from paying tribute to the emperor. They were able to govern themselves. As citizens, they had the right to buy and sell property. They were free from indiscriminate arrest. You know, Paul made that argument many times. I'm a Roman citizen. These people experienced that privilege. It was a population of mixed cultures, Greek, European, and Romans. It had a lot of retired Roman soldiers. They would often be sent out to populate the colonies. So these people in this town were proud of their Roman citizenry and their connection. It would have also, this is an overview today of that area, it would be considered a prosperous city. It was located on the Via Ignatia, which was a very important road. Probably, and the Romans changed the world by their developing their road systems. I'm sure you've heard that before. And here's a picture of the Via Ignatia. It stretches from that coast over there, it's the red line, over to here. Guess where our city is we're studying today? Right here, smack dab in the middle. Also, what I'll show you is if you cross the sea and you go over here into Italy, this is also a Roman road. It just changes its name. That's the Via Appia, or the Appian Way. The reason it changed the road system is because now trade and commerce could move back and forth. News of other parts of the world could do it. And our little Philippi was right there in the middle of all of that. Bustling commerce. Do we have a businesswoman in our story today? I've showed you the Appian Way. This is another picture of the Via Ignatia. This time what was in red is in yellow. Now, Philippi is starting all the way over here on this side, but the reason I wanted to show you this is because look at the next few cities on the route, Amphipolis, Apollonia, Thessalonica. What's interesting about that is when Paul steps out of Philippi and moves on his way, the Bible records he went to Amphipolis, Apollonia, and Thessalonica. Do you think he was walking that road? I think he probably was. Now, he's going to veer off, though, because his next stop will be coming over here to visit the Bereans. But I thought that was interesting to see what fell along that road. This is the Via Ignatia today in the city, the ruins of Philippi. This would have ran alongside the marketplace. And these are the ruins of the city we're talking about today. We know from the Bible, later on, if you keep digging into the chapter, several things happen. So we know that there's a river, where Lydia was found, a marketplace, it had magistrates and authorities, there was a prison with a jailer, and there was policemen. And I believe, right down here at the bottom of the screen, they believe that was the jail. So our little Philippi is a unique city. It's a little like Rome but it's full of Greek culture, and it's located on European soil. So what we need to do is picture Lydia in her everyday life living here. But the most significant thing about this city of Philippi, remember the map I showed you where they wanted to go this way and that way, and then the vision said, go here, go to Macedonia. The thing you need to remember about Philippi is that's where the Lord wanted these men, very clearly. So we've gone over the we and our column of Philippi. So now let's look at Lydia herself. Now, this is going to get into some speculation because we don't have any facts other than what was listed about Lydia. But I can tell you what's known of Roman history and culture at that time, just as long as you understand this is all guess-sos. How old would Lydia have been? Well, the life expectancy for a woman in her time was about 35. Who in here is 35 or older? We might have been questionable. They did have older people in their 80s to 90s. The difference between our culture is we have a lot of people in the older age bracket. They didn't. A lot of women died, and the reason that age was so young because of childbirth. But we, in just guessing, my best guess would be she's somewhere in the middle age range, just because she's got a household and she's running a business. What's her status? Well, every reference to her indicates she was on her own. All the scholars that I looked up felt like she would have been a woman on her own because of the phrasing. I don't know if that meant she was single, widowed, or divorced. I can't even say 100% that she was alone, even though that seems to be the strong feeling. What most scholars felt like is she would have been widowed because of having a household and having a business. That seemed to be the most probable, but we can't know for sure. What was her background? I've already told you she was from Thyatira. That was about 200 miles away. It was in the Asian area that Paul had been forbidden to go. And I don't know if you noticed it, but that area where Thyatira was actually called Lydia. Some scholars think that maybe the Bible should have said a woman from Lydia rather than calling her by her name. But we're just going to go with Lydia. Guess what Thyatira was famous for? Dyeing and indigo trade. Do you think she might have learned that from her hometown? Also, you might not have made this connection before. Thyatira is one of the seven churches of Asia mentioned in Revelation. So we can speculate about how they would have received the gospel. Paul is going to be in that vicinity on his third journey. Maybe he stopped into there, but we don't know. Family. We know Lydia had a household, but beyond that, we don't know what that means. In that time, that could have been a mixture of relatives, servants, and even militia, because wealthy homes would have needed it to be well guarded. So she had some mix of that for it to be called a household. It was, what you can know about that is it was a lot of responsibility for a woman on her own in ancient times. Here's a picture of a household. To me, I have no idea, but this strikes me as being maybe an upper middle class house. It's certainly not the poorest. It's certainly not the grandest I came across. And I recognize Lydia may not have been a well-off person, even though a seller of purple fabrics seems to lead you in that direction. Her everyday home life would have been a lot about survival and hard work because everything came from scratch. You would have to grow your food. You would have to weave your clothes. And everybody had to work together for the households to accomplish all of that. They would be busy gathering and preparing bread. It's said that sometimes it would take half a day just for the household to prepare enough bread for everybody. There would be tending livestock, spinning and weaving, sewing of garments. You add into that the pressure of running a business, and there probably wouldn't have been a lot of rest for her. And we can understand that, right? We can sympathize with her. Here's a picture of maybe a city street in that time. Notice that a lot of the people are wearing more colorless tunics. Things with color in it would have cost more. So when you see pictures when everybody's wearing a lot of color, I'm not sure that would be exactly accurate unless maybe you're in the middle of a palace or something. Two interesting things for us in this day and time about back then. Low-carb people and gluten-free people, you might be in trouble. 50% or more of the diet was from grains. For us clean people, we're really going to be hurting. The typical ancient laundry detergent was a mixture of caustic soda and vinegar, and ammonia was also very valuable. Guess where they got ammonia from? Urine collecting pots out on the street. I just hope Lydia had a different kind of cleaner. Lydia was a businesswoman. She traded in a commodity that seems to be purchased by the wealthiest and most elite in society. It's safe to assume that she might have comported herself as a businesswoman that catered to that kind of crowd, if that's what we're talking about. What I mean by that is dressing for success. If you're going to be interacting with the wealthiest and most elite, you might have an image you need to maintain. Remember, this is all supposition, but try to use common sense when you try to identify with Lydia. Because she might have been trying to maintain a connection with some elite clientele, I would think her cleanliness standards would have been very high. She wouldn't have been dirty and unkept. In that time, bathhouses were very common. Now, I think this is $2,000 for what I'm talking about. This might have been in a palace or something, but this is a typical picture of a bathhouse, and it was common for everybody to go to the public bathhouse. The women would go in the morning, and the men would go in the evening, and sometimes they didn't keep that separated too good. And they would also be, they could be rubbed down with perfumed oils there. Perfumed oils are referred to several times in the Bible. I would have a whole big problem with this. I didn't even like to get undressed and changed in the girls' locker rooms at school. I think I would have had to do something at home. And maybe they did. Maybe they had, you could do sponge baths. Lydia, what kind of clothing would she have dressed in? Women of that time, obviously, you know, as we do today, sometimes you dress up, sometimes you dress down. There would have been a different range of things that she might have worn. She possibly could have worn something that would highlight the purple fabric she hoped to sell. And that's not really far-fetched when you think about it. Remember Proverbs 31, verse 22, it says, "She makes tapestry for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple." And I thought this was an interesting note. You know how today when we talk about the upper crust of society, the blue-blooded people? Back then, they thought of them as the purple-blooded people. Girls, you see that one of these ladies is wearing a veil up here. I don't know if Lydia would have been wearing a veil or not, but something that I thought was very interesting, a Jewish tradition to this day, see if you can figure out where this comes from. The groom places the veil over the bride's face himself after he gets a look at her. I think I know where that story might have come from. Okay, Lydia, she would have been just like us. This is different hairstyles of that time. Some of them look really elaborate, and I'm sure they also could also be very plain. Lydia, I don't know how she looked, but she would have fixed her hair and makeup as appropriate to someone of her position and station. You know, we don't think about this, but people of ancient times, they wore sandals. Did you know they had platform shoes with heels to add height? They had wigs. They had hair dye. And they had treatments for baldness. What do you think this is? These are makeup powders. It would be similar to our mineral makeups of today. They had eye paint, rouge, face powders, mirrors, not very good mirrors, wrinkle creams. And there was a few differences in this makeup. It was known the coal eyeliner, the black, it was good for keeping the flies away. But there was a reason for that. It's because it contained lead and arsenic. Wouldn't want to have used that makeup. I you know, I Myself, I never really think of Bible women in these terms, but they would have been women just like us. And we miss a lot of things in Scripture. Look at, for instance, Isaiah. There's a list of things that should have brought this to our mind. Ankle bracelets, necklaces, earrings, bracelets, veils, scarves, ankle chains, cloth belts, bottles of perfume, charms, signet rings, nose rings, fine dresses, robes, veils, purses, mirrors, linen dresses, turbans, long shawls. This is a list of things that the women of that time valued, but they were going to shortly lose because they had failed to follow God properly. Women in Bible times were just like us. Some were gaudy and some weren't. Some were stylish and some weren't. They spent different amounts of time on their hair and makeup, jewelry, shoes, clothing. And you know what else? They had issues of vanity, just like us. And they had issues of modesty and immodesty, just like us. Girls, that would be a great treasure trail to go down and look into some of those issues that would pertain to women. And Lydia would have been no different. Had you ever before today really identified with Lydia as a woman and thought about all those things that she would have been? You know, we have hang-ups and insecurities about how we look and things all related to what I've just gone over. Lydia would have been just like that. Now, there's a lot of things we have in common, but and all these things I've listed here, are all, it's a lot about speculation. But these things down here, these were some ways she was unique. In ancient times, as a woman, she seemed to manage a home alone. In ancient times, as a woman, she seemed to manage a business. And this is a fact, no speculation. In an idol-worshipping city, she was a worshiper of God. That's another way she was different. Okay, for you to know the whole scope about Lydia, we need to talk a little bit about her business. The purple fabric industry. Tyrian purple was known to be an imperial or royal commodity. It had a very distinct hue. It went from a blue to kind of a reddish purple. And I tell you, I would be fascinated to see what this really looked like. Modern computer graphics, they say, cannot recreate it. But I don't think in real life they've been able to recreate this exact thing either, because it was so valued because it intensified its hue, even with weathering and being exposed to light. Now, any of you who work with fabric know that doesn't happen. So I would have been fascinated to know more about that. Ancient purple dye, I'm going to talk about a couple different sources that could have come from. The first one that really got my attention was the one that comes from the mucus of the hypobranchial gland of a certain shellfish. You see this right up here? This is a murex shell. You see that ugly, nasty thing coming out of it? That's a sea snail. Inside that sea snail is a special gland, and inside that gland is mucus. And if you can get him to bleh that up, that's purple. Now, this over here is somebody doing that. They're milking a sea snail. They've wrapped a bunch of uncolored fibers over their hand. They're at the coast, and they're poking and milking the snail. And that's taken forever just to get that little bit, and that's by no means the intense color we're talking about. Now, you could do that. You could take one sea snail at a time and poke it and milk it, and I don't think you're going to get very far in your purple fabric business. So guess what they did instead? They would gather up massive amounts of shellfish, and they would crush them, shells and snails and all. And they would throw in some salt, and then they would let it steep for a few days. As the ancient writers were trying to relay what they did, every one of them said the stench was horrific. You need to appreciate people wearing purple today. Think about Lydia. On the 10th, then they would start boiling it and boiling it and boiling it. On the 10th day, they would, the worst part would be the person that had this job. As it's boiling for all those days, you have to skim off the guts and the shell and the veins till you get down to the pure stuff. So I don't know. They didn't have oxygen masks back then. They would throw in pure wool and let it soak for hours. And they would draw it out, and they would card it, and they would put it back in. And this process would continue until it has soaked up the fullest hue of that dye. And what they were looking for, reddish, would have been inferior. They were looking for a deep blackish purple. It's said to have taken 12,000 shellfish to get 1/3 of a teaspoon of pure dye. Do you see now why this was only for the royal people? 1.5 grams, 0.05 ounce for crushing that many shellfish. That would be enough to dye the trim of a garment. The dye itself, the pure dye, was said to fetch its weight in silver. A garment dyed in purple was said to have fetched its weight in gold. There's ancient records where a king denied his wife a purple outfit because he couldn't afford it. Now, the other way that the purple dye might have been achieved was through a madder root. And I'll tell you that Farrell Jenkins and Leon Malden prefer this scenario of where it comes through. And I'd really like to talk to them about it because I don't quite understand. The reason they say is because her dyeing technique probably came from her home city of Thyatira. And if you remember where it was located, it's an inland. It's not right on the coast. However, it's on a river is what it looked like to me. So there would have been an outlet. But even so, that's not where Lydia is today. Maybe she perfected her dyeing technique and was doing the shell thing in Philippi because that is a coastal city. But the biggest reason I don't really know how to explain that is the madder root produced more of a reddish dye. In fact, the British redcoats came from the madder root. So it says Lydia was a seller of purple fabric. Maybe that's all in the translation, but it's just very interesting to note what would have gone into something, a dye this intense, meant for royalty. Also, you might remember that the Lord had purple interwoven in the different vestments and in the pieces of the temple. Today, genuine Tyrian purple remains the domain of the rich and famous. So far, we have gone over several of our groupings. The last part we need to cover, we've covered we've covered the cities, we've covered Lydia herself and her business. Now we're going to look at the most important, the spiritual connection in this place, the spiritual state of the community. Number one, there was no synagogue that we noted. Why was that? Every time Paul would go into a city, he would go to the synagogue. Well, history tells us that's most likely due to the fact that the Roman Emperor Claudius had gotten aggravated with the Jews back in Rome, and he'd issued an edict expelling them out of Rome. Now, that's really important because that connects to our story this afternoon. Priscilla and Aquila are introduced to us after they've been expelled from Rome. And you can kind of say a prayer for that over lunch, because every time I've gone over that story recently, I get choked up about it. And it's okay for us to share some tears over it, because it's a touching story, what we'll cover this afternoon, but I need to be able to speak. But anyway, Claudius had thrown the Jews out. Roman colonies usually followed suit with what Rome did, so it's surmised Philippi had thrown the Jews out, copying Rome. It takes at least 10 Jewish men to have a synagogue, hence no synagogue. The other spiritual thing you need to realize about this town, we've already touched on, pagan idol worship was everywhere. There would have been praying and sacrificing and performing religious rituals, and this would have been in their homes and all around the city. And trade guilds would be a very important consideration. Back in Thyatira was a huge dyeing industry, and trade guilds were very popular. People who were all knew the same trade would all belong to the guild together. They didn't describe it so much like unions that we have today, but it would be more like a social club, but it was a social club with power. They would help each other. They would shut each other. They would shut somebody coming into town out of business if they didn't belong to the guild. But the key thing is they would worship idols as part of being successful in their trade. They would pray to gods to help them, and they would get together and make a party about that. And there were a lot of early Christians that felt like you could not honor Christ and be part of one of these trade guilds. This would have been big in the dyeing industry. You can see where this is possibly a very big stumbling block for Lydia in her future. And the last thing is Christians. There was no mentions of Christians being in this town. There are some on the outskirts and cities around it. But what we need to remember and what we're keep focusing on, even though there's no Christians in this town, the Lord wants that to change. So you know a little bit about Lydia's everyday life and stresses and how she would try to have balanced all this on her own, about the serious spiritual challenges she would have faced there, and how God had provided and directed very special men, very capable men, to come right where she was. And this is where they found her, at this river, praying and seeking. You know, I couldn't help but think about her when Becky was talking about the verse in 2 Chronicles, the eyes of the Lord are skimming over the whole earth, looking for the hearts that are committed to Him. It just gives me chills. He saw Lydia, and He sent people here. Maybe there were other people that He saw too. And God also made a point that this got recorded for us to be reading about today. It should move us all to see how Lydia's heart was ready. She was seeking and praying when her opportunity came. And when it came, she soaked it up. Everything they were saying, she grabbed hold of the gospel, and she wanted to be in Christ. In fact, she had lived such a life of influence to those around her that when she was ready, they were all ready too. And after speaking to these men and studying, Lydia was baptized and her whole household. And for me, that's where the story usually ends. But there's a lot more to that. After the baptisms, did Lydia wake up to another busy day? I can imagine that maybe they stayed up late that night talking and studying. Remember, she urged the men to come back and stay at her house. She might have had many more questions. These men stayed many days, so she was balancing meeting their needs, the needs of her household. Maybe she had to continue with some business things. But there is one big difference. She and her household feel different. They are different. Their prayers were answered. They are fellow Christians, and they now have a special bond with these men staying with them. Sadly, the people in her community did not have that same reaction. During the course of their stay, Paul and Silas ran into some trouble in the community when Paul heals a fortune teller. Acts 16:19 talks about this incident. They grabbed Paul and Silas and dragged them before the city rulers because her managers were not happy she'd been healed of that talent that was making the money. They said, "These men are Jews. Remember, maybe they're not supposed to be Jews in this city, and they're making trouble. They are teaching things not right for Romans to do." You see that proud mindset of being a Roman colony? The crowd attacked them. The officers tore the clothes off of them, and they beat them with rods. And Paul and Silas were thrown into jail and guarded very carefully. Lydia would probably have been brought news of this very quickly, don't you think? The town would have known they were staying with her. Maybe her and her household were very anxious. Maybe they even ran to the jail to see what they could do. I can tell you, this would have been a significant emotional event for these new Christians. It would have had to have distressed even Luke and Timothy. You can imagine they all would have been anxious for Luke to get in there and check on these men, being a physician. Can you put yourselves in Paul and Silas's place as they're in the jail cell? They might have been asking each other about their injuries, how were they hurt, maybe filling each other in. Maybe they had been separated on what had happened. Did they have a fear about what would happen to them the next day? They might have even talked about, I wonder if something has happened to Lydia and her household for even housing us. A lot could have been on their mind. Yet somehow in their hearts, they were able to step back and see that they had just suffered for the cause of Christ. It moved them, and together they began singing hymns. And while the jailer slept, the other prisoners in the dark heard those hymns. Would you be able to do that after what happened to those men, to be able to sit in the dark with all that on your mind, suffering from injuries and wounds that would have to be treated later, and sing praises to God? Well, that would have been enough for one day. But then there was an earthquake. All those back at Lydia's house might have felt it too, maybe the whole town, because it shook the very foundations of the jailhouse. I did it on purpose.
Okay.
It certainly woke the jailer, and when he saw the chaos, the prison doors all opened, he realized his fate and drew his sword to commit suicide rather than face whatever punishment was in store. What an unbelievable moment when he heard the prisoners shouting they were still there. You know what? How did Paul know to shout out right at that moment? I've read that several times. It's dark. The jailer couldn't see him. How did Paul know he was fixing to kill himself? But the jailer was so moved when he heard that that he fell down, trembling, without hesitation, and asked how he could be saved too. I've often wondered how he knew these men could give him that information. Had he heard of Lydia and her household and how they'd been saved? That's maybe probable if she was a prominent member of the community. People would have talked. And her house guests, Paul and these men, were certainly not silent as they were going around town. But did you remember that fortune teller girl had gone for days shouting all over town behind them as they walked through? These men are the servants of the Most High God who are telling you the way to be saved. So it's not surprising then that the jailer would have known they could have helped him with that. So in the middle of the night, injured, they had a Bible study. The jailer treated their wounds, and they all went somewhere to be baptized. How did they just walk out of the prison and nobody notice? I've often wondered. But then you remember the earthquake. Maybe the whole city was in chaos, and that helped them be able to carry this out without any interference. The bottom line is the very fearful jailer, he's full of joy now. He and his whole household are now children of God. Does that sound familiar? That's just kind of a repeat of what happened with Lydia and her household. Well, the next morning comes, and all the worst things that you can imagine never come to pass because they just want to forget it now. And Paul doesn't want them to forget it because they've mistreated a Roman citizen. So they're very fearful, and they come and they say, oh, we're real sorry, but could you please leave town? And by the way, an earthquake about 500 years later wipes out this town. Well, verse 40. So when they came out of the jail, they went to Lydia's house where they saw some of the believers and encouraged them. And then they left. So within a few days of the start of those verses that we read at the beginning, you have the church in Philippi being born, and now you have the church being added to with the jailer and his household. I don't know about you, but I would have felt very sad to see these men leave town, but it sure would have been comforting to know now there was another family who could share what my heart was for Christ now. And remember what I told you as those men walked out of town, who stayed behind? Luke. Luke was still going to stay in this area. Is this all we know about this? No, that's not all we know. Never fear. This group of people and Paul would keep a special bond between themselves for the rest of his life until his death. We can dig up and discover more because Paul's going to come back here on another journey. And also because Paul is going to write them a very special letter, one of my favorite epistles, Philippians. Turn to Philippians. Philippians chapter 1. right there in the first verse, it says, the church that began with Lydia now has elders and deacons. Isn't that encouraging? And I think, could the jailer have been one of their elders and deacons now? That's how the church has matured and progressed from this setup that we've started. Also, verse 1, 29 to 30. The church that began with Lydia is now suffering and being persecuted just like Paul. What does that mean? Were some of them in prison now? Chapter 4, verse 15 to 18. The church that began with Lydia is also single-handedly providing support for Paul over many years to the point of risking one of their lives to bring it to him. And in Corinthians, we find another reference possibly to them. In the midst of a very severe trial, their overflowing joy and their extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity. They gave as much as they were able and even beyond their ability. They exceeded our expectations. They gave themselves first of all to the Lord and then by the will of God to us. That brings a lot of questions to my mind. If we think of Lydia as an affluent woman, that always made sense to me that her church kept up with Paul and could send him support time and time again. I don't know if that's the case, but if that was the case, something has drastically changed. You know, we talked about trade guilds and how that might have affected her after what happened in Philippi, and over time, if they continued as Christians, maybe the community blackballed her business. Maybe the jailer lost his position. People could have given a lot in this time to have served Christ. I would say, now you know the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey says, but I had never dug into all that had to do with Lydia until I was putting this together. And I'll tell you, I'm really not done with things that I'd like to know. Why wasn't Lydia mentioned in the book of Philippians? Did that mean she traveled somewhere else? Did Lydia go back to Thyatira? Was she somehow connected to there being a church there later that was referred to in Revelations? As I said, did living and working and sharing so much of their wealth make these brethren poor eventually, or they lost their standing in the community and their jobs because of being a Christian? Did Lydia ever marry again? Did she get put into prison? And something very interesting in Philippians 4, 2-3, Paul speaks of a true companion, my true companion, and goes on, who is that? I really would like to know those questions. These questions come to us when these people become real to us. Lydia is real to me after I've studied her in this way. My goal was to paint a picture of a real woman we could all identify with and take inspiration from, but that wasn't my only goal. It was also to share the thrill of discovering these things that you can find in a deeper, richer Bible study. We need to remember that God thought what was in this Bible was so important that He went to great lengths and He intervened in men's lives to get this into our hands. We are very blessed to have it. It is very powerful. It is amazingly full of things we need to dig into, and all we have to have is the heart to dig into it and seek into it. I really loved my time studying about Lydia, and I'm going to finish out having some words read aloud that would have come from Paul that Lydia might have repeated to herself every day to help her get through her days.